Good morning, brethren and sisters, respected friends. In this year of firsts, believe it or not, this is a first for me. I've never given an exhortation at High, even though I've been down here a few years. So this is both exciting and scary. As it was, I would imagine, for our first-time exhorters. In fact, it's so scary, you will not notice my wife here. She no longer has the children to hide behind, so I believe my grandson is the victim this year. This morning, we're going to study about Samson. He was considered by all of us the strong man of Israel. We're going to talk about strength, both physical strength and spiritual strength. This exhortation will not give us any of that physical strength. If you wanted that, you would have to go to the gym. And if I go long, it's because I can't see the watch. But we are here simply to gain spiritual strength. The Apostle Paul exhorts us in 1 Timothy to refuse profane and old wives' fables and exercise ourselves rather unto godliness. For bodily exercise profiteth little, but godliness is profitable unto all things, having the promise of life that now is and of that which is to come. We are told over and over again in the Scriptures where we can gain this strength. In 2 Samuel 22, it says, David saying, God is my strength and power. He maketh my way perfect. Or in Psalms, the Lord will give strength unto his people. We need to remember that. The Lord will bless his people with peace. And although this exhortation this morning is centered around Samson, hopefully we should be strengthened by the lessons of it. We learn from his life. We learn from his death. They were found in Judges chapters 16 to 20. But the big question is, what are we to do with that strength that we derive from this lesson? We've been given that answer also. Jesus says in Mark 12, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart. It sounds so simple. And with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. Notice the all in there. This is the first commandment. But before we get into Samson, we need to understand what he was living, where he was, and the time period to which he was born into. We've been studying the Judges this week. We started at the first, and now we're at the end. We've traveled through time from the time of Joshua all the way to the end, with Samuel being the last judge. We know that Samson was of the tribe of Dan, and that Joshua also gave them their inheritance. Concerning the inheritance of Dan, we read in Joshua 19:40-48, and the seventh lot came out for the children of Dan according to their families. And the coast of their inheritance was Zorah, Eshtaol, Ershemesh, and a host of other cities. That was their boundary. The coast of Dan was too little for them. Therefore the children of Dan went up to fight against Elishim, and took it and smote it with the edge of the sword and possessed it and dwelt therein, and called Elishim Dan, after the name of Dan their father. This inheritance of tribe of Dan according to their families and with their villages. Here we just read, the coast of Dan was too little for them. God had given them an inheritance. It was right next to Judah. They were the fourth largest tribe. How could it be so little for them? But we note that the little is in italics and not in the original. The problem wasn't that they weren't given enough area, but they didn't conquer that area that they were to inherit. We read in Judges 18, and in these days there was no king in Israel. In those days, the tribe of the Danites sought an inheritance to dwell in. They sought an inheritance. This is 400 years after they already received their inheritance. The inheritance had not fallen into them among the tribes. And then later in Judges, we're told why. The Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains, for they would not suffer them to come down into the valley. We know, brethren and sisters, if their faith had been strong enough, the area would have been large enough, because the Amorites wouldn't have been there. But instead, they looked for another inheritance. Do we see a comparison there in our lives? Is our inheritance too hard for us to obtain? Do we seek an inheritance elsewhere in the world? Or do we gain strength from the lessons of old and go on and fight the battles of flesh so that we may overcome it and stand at that judgment seat and receive that gift of immortality? Let's go back to Judges 18 in the second verse. It tells us that the children of Dan sent of their family 5 men from their coasts, men of valor. That seems kind of ironic. Men of valor. And they're not living in the cities they were to inherit. They're living in the mountains outside. From Zorah and Eshtaol to spy out the land and search it. Then in the 7th verse, the men come back from Laish and saw a people wherein how they dwelt carelessly after the manner of the Zidonians, quiet and secure. There was no magistrate in the land that might put them to shame, and they were far from the Zidonians and had no business with any man. These men left Zorah and Eshtaol, the land that was given to them, and went north to find greener pastures. And they brought back a report that we read in verses 8 to 10. And they came to their brethren, to Zorah and Eshtaol, and said to them, "Arise, go up against them, for we have seen the land, and behold, it is very good. And are ye still? Be not slothful to go and enter and possess the land. When ye go, ye shall come to a people that is secure, to a large land. For God hath given it into your hands, a place where there is no want of anything in the earth." We can see what attracted their attention. Imagine a place where there is no want of anything. A people, secure, a large land. It was going to be easy. They were willing to leave God's inheritance for that easy life, for that appealing life. Is the life of the truth too difficult for us? Do we desire the easier things of the world? Eshtaol, the place they were leaving, if we look back in Numbers, is the place where the spies brought out the grapes when Moses sent them in to spy out the land. And they cut down one cluster of grapes, and they bear it between two on a staff. And this was the land they were leaving to go to greener pastures. How could that be? And using the dates in the Companion Bible, we find that it appears that Dan moved some 20 years after they received their inheritance. They went north. But we have Samson about 300 years after the rest of the tribe had moved north. We're not told how many, but that's another exhortation in itself. We're just told that Manoah and his wife were living between Zorah and Eshtaol, outside the city in the mountains, two cities that were part of their inheritance. We go to Judges 13, and that sets the stage for us. It says, "The children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. And there was a certain man of Zorah, of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah." In this name, we see Noah, which means to rest, and Manoah means a settled spot. This man had found a settled spot when the rest of the tribe had gone north. We also know that Samson's mother was not named. She was barren, as were other women in the Bible, Sarah, Rebecca, Hannah, and Elizabeth. And we can also see how the divine hand was in Samson's birth. In Judges 13, we read of it. "And the angel of the Lord appeared unto the woman and said unto her, Behold, now thou art barren and bearest not, but thou shalt conceive and bear a son, Now therefore beware, I pray thee, and drink not wine nor strong drink, and eat not any unclean thing. For the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. The purpose of the Nazarite vow was so that man or woman could imitate the high priest. The Nazarite vow consisted of three things. They were not to drink wine or strong drink. They were not to eat of the fruit of the vine. Neither were they to come near a dead body. And they were not to cut their hair. Considering the Nazarite vow in Numbers 6, it says that all the days that he separateth himself unto the Lord, he shall come near no dead body. But this is not stated in what was given Samson's mother. She was told not to eat the unclean thing. But we know that Samson was delivered Israel from the Philistines, so that his work would require him to be among the unclean people and among the dead bodies. In number 6, it reads, all the days of the vow of separation, there shall no razor come upon his head until the days be fulfilled which he separateth himself unto the Lord. And he shall be holy, and he shall let the locks of his head grow. This was a symbol of a consecrated head, one that was set apart or holy. We know that Samson judged Israel for 20 years, but we are also said that he was only able to begin the deliverance. Samuel continued the work that he had started. His mother also was barren, and he was called and lent to the Lord, separated for a special work. These two people, Samson and Samuel, lived two very different lives, but they were working to accomplish the same goal, just as all of us are here today. Some are accountants, some are IT people, some in the medical field, some farmers. But we are all here to accomplish just one goal, to gain the spiritual strength and to strengthen others as we work to destroy the uncircumcised Philistine and overcome the sin of the flesh. Continuing on in Judges 13:24, we read, and the woman bare a son and called his name Samson. And the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. The name Samson means sunlight. And we'll need that name later on in the meaning. The words were spoken here are repeated of John the Baptist and similarly of Christ. The child grew, and Yahweh blessed him. Continuing on Judges 13:25, it reads, and the Spirit of the Lord began to move him at times in the camp of Dan between Zorah and Eshtaol. This is a very important aspect of Samson. The Spirit of the Lord began to move him at times. He was spasmodic, which Judges 14:4 reads, and then Samson went down to Timnath. He saw a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. I always misread this verse. I was thinking that when Samson went down to Timnath, he was looking for a woman. He was looking for a wife. But that's not really what it infers. He went down to Timnath, which means the assigned place, the assigned portion, and he saw a woman. He had not gone down into the world, but he was within the land that was allotted to Judah and or Dan. Sometimes, brothers and sisters, we're not purposely setting out to do something wrong. Our intentions may be good, but something or someone we see tempts us and we stray from that straight path. We do know that the Philistines should have been driven out of the land when the Israelites conquered it. So this woman had no right to be there. If they had done as God had commanded them 20 years ago, or I guess 320 years ago, when they first came in the land, Samson would not have seen this woman and the problem he encountered, and actually all his problems would not have happened. He saw a woman. The problem was Samson's eyes. Every time he went against the Philistines, we know that God helped him. But when he saw the women, it went the opposite direction, and Yahweh left him. He spasmodically served God. It appears as he was genuinely concerned about the inheritance of the Israelites, and he wanted to fight the enemy. He wanted to clean up the land, but his eyes drew him away. In Judges 14, he came up and he told his father and his mother and said, "I have seen a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. Therefore, now get her to me for wife." How crushing that must have been to them. The Philistines, we are told, went down in history as being a brutal, coarse, and a dirty nation. The very name Philistine means to wallow in the dust. And the meaning is verified in Micah chapter 1 and verse 10, where there is a play upon words in the name of the Philistines. "In the house of Aphra," he said, "roll thyself in the dust." And Aphra means dust. And in condemnation of Gath in Philistia, that's what Micah said, "In the house of dust, roll thyself in the dust." So the Philistines were of the earth, earthy, and they were called by other nations, and by Israel, the uncircumcised. But Ezekiel tells us that the Philistines were actually ashamed of Israel. That's what the conditions were like. That a uncircumcised nation like the Philistines were ashamed. How a great nation had become so low. Now we go back to Samson. Samson tells his parents that he wants to marry outside the truth. His mother and his father appeal to him in verse 3 and say, "Is there never a woman among the daughters of thy brethren?" They appeal to him to marry within the truth. Paul said that a woman who lost her husband by death was free to marry, but only in the Lord. And that, brethren and sisters, is not just a commandment. It is a commandment. But because God has said so. But it is because marriage, as we have discussed this week, is the most intimate relationship between a man and a woman, being secondly only to our service to God. How difficult it is to live a life in the truth when a husband and a wife are pulling in opposite directions. How difficult it would be to bring up a child or a family in that atmosphere where there's no unity of mind. And so his parents make an appeal, I would imagine with tears. And they say, "Or among all my people, among all the tribes. But don't go to the uncircumcised Philistines." Verse 3 brings us back again to the root of the problem, his eyes. Samson says, "For she pleases me well." But the margin says, "She is right in my eyes." Samson, we know, is a type of Israel where everyone is doing what is right in their own eyes. In verse 4 of Judges 14, it says, "But his father and his mother knew not that it was of the Lord, that he sought an occasion against the Philistines. For at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel." If we look into the Septuagint, it says, "Yahweh sought a quarrel." He didn't make Samson do wrong, but he used that opportunity to bring about his purpose. "Then Samson went down with his father and his mother to Timnath." They made many trips, I would imagine. But I would imagine his mother only made one. And verse 5 continues, "And they came to the vineyards of Timnath, and behold, a young lion roared against him." Timnah means the inheritance, as I said, or the assigned portion. And a vineyard, we know, is a symbol of inheritance. "When Samson went into the vineyard of Timnath, a young lion roared against him." Chapter 15, verse 14. That young lion should not have been there. It shouldn't have been in the vineyard, just like the Philistines shouldn't have been there in Timnath. This reminds us of Psalm 80, where we read about the wild beasts that trample down the vineyard. A vineyard, as we've noticed, grow up around here, take a long time to grow. And the wild beasts could be very destructive in a very short time. Then we look at our ecclesias. Our ecclesias also take time to grow and to develop. And we must work constantly to keep that worldly influence out of them. Verse 6 reads, "And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he rent him as he would rent a kid, and he had nothing in his hand." This is the same Spirit, that same source of strength that he will use against the Philistines. This was not a battle fought with carnal weapons. And we, brethren and sisters, we are not fighting a battle with carnal weapons when we fight off the desires of the flesh. We must use that strength that we spoke of earlier from the Spirit Word. And then it says, Samson went home, but he didn't tell them of his victory over the lion. It's very appropriate that Samson's problem did not appear to be pride. But later we're told he returned to see the ruin, or the carcass, of that lion. And he sees a swarm of bees. Zora means sting. But it's not just bees that were there. There was also honey. Honey, as we know, was also mentioned as part of Israel's inheritance. They were given a land flowing with milk and honey. The time came for the marriage to be consummated. We read in verse 10, "And his father went down." We don't read of his mother and his father going down to make arrangements, for we can only imagine how opposed they were to it. And then, as the Philistine custom was, they made a feast. Here we have a Nazarite making a feast. Like Amos said, "I have your children to be Nazarites, and you gave them to wine and to drink." He's organizing a feast with his new Gentile friends, his new Philistine friends, a party with wine and drink for 7 days. He seems to be enjoying this new feast, his newfound freedom. He's now the center of attention. He's got 30 new friends. But notice who's missing. None of his people came. In Judges 14, verses 12, it says, "And Samson said to them, I will now put forth a riddle to you. And if you can declare it unto me within the days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 sheets and 30 changes of garments. But if you cannot declare it unto me, then ye shall give me 30 sheets and 30 changes of garments." And he put forth his riddle. The RSV renders the 30 sheets as linen garments, which were symbols of righteousness. The same words that were used in Isaiah for the clothing of the bridegroom. And Samson's going to be a bridegroom. Continuing on, we read, "And he said to them, out of the eater came forth meat, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. And they could not in 3 days expound the riddle. And it came to pass on the seventh day," which we would really mean the fourth day, "that they said unto Samson's wife, entice thy husband, that he may declare unto us the riddle, lest we burn thee and thy father's house with fire." We can see her reaction. "And Samson's wife wept before him and said, thou dost hate me. They're not even married. Thou dost hate me and thou lovest me not. Thou hast put forth a riddle to the children of my people and hast not told me." And his retort, "And he said unto her, behold, I have not told my father or my mother, and shall I tell it thee?" Notice her words. "You don't really love me. You haven't told my people." And his response, "I haven't told my folks either." Are they in the same camp? Is there any unity in this union that is to happen? Your people, my people. In today's terms, we know that his people would never accept her people or her. "And she wept before him for 7 days while the feast lasted. And it came to pass on the seventh day he told her, because she lay sore upon him. And she told the riddle to her people. And the men of the city came to him and gave him the answer. What is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion?" Notice the timing here. It was just before the sun set. If the sun had set, it would have been too late. He would have gotten the garments. The marriage would have been consummated, and Samson would have been unequally yoked with a Philistine woman. But before the sun went down, he told her the riddle. His name, remember, means sunlight. And just before it dipped below the horizon, God rescued him from this marriage. If we put ourselves in Samson's position, would we have been upset? I can only imagine. Would we say that's not fair? Most likely. But look at the blessing that this marriage was not consummated. And then we're told that Samson went to Ashkelon, which means a market. And he went shopping for 30 garments. However, they were occupied at the time. And again, we see how God used an opportunity to have his will be done. Ashkelon was one of the other major cities of the Philistines, but there were 30 less of the hierarchy there. We go on into the 15th chapter, and it says that Samson was willing to apologize and forgive and forget and let life go on. He brings a kid up to his wife and says, "I will go into the chamber." As we know through history, it is an act of reconciliation. He's going back to the world, and he's apologizing to the Philistines. This is so like us, brothers and sisters. We attend a gathering at High or October or in Richard or the study weekends. And we come away, and where do we go? Do we go back home and get into that same rut that we tried to climb out of? We need to think about it. When Samson arrives to the house, the woman's father says, "I barely thought that thou hated her, so I gave her to thy companion," or it would have been his best man at his wedding. He gave her to a Philistine. But he says, "I've got something better for you." You know, she's got a younger sister, and she's cuter. You know, just look at her eyes. I pray thee, take her instead. We can see God's hand in this also. He's saving him again from making a bad decision. By her father giving the first woman to another, Samson was not able to fulfill his purpose. Is not her younger sister fairer? Is this a way to choose a wife? By looks? Once again, Samson's eyes. And then Samson says, "This time I shall be blameless in regard to the Philistines." In other words, this time it'll serve him right. So in Judges 15:14, Samson went and he caught 300 foxes. They weren't foxes, they were jackals. Jackals will eat only of a dead body. If it moves, they run. They run in packs. They will not go alone. And he took firebrands or a torch and put them tail to tail and let them loose. Can we imagine 150 little torches running all over through the standing corn? As we heard this morning, you take your harvest, you stand it up in sheaves. You have these little foxes or jackals running around lighting up all your sheaves. That was the crop that was just harvested. Then we have the corn that's still standing. They run through it. Imagine one on each side of a row going through your field. Then they go to the vineyards. Then they go to the olive yards. Here we have their whole economy destroyed. Some were ready to harvest. Some had been harvested. And then we talk about the vineyards that take years and years, or the olive trees, which could live for up to 2,000 years. And this is one effort of Samson and the Spirit of Yahweh. This brought the Philistines out. It brought them out of the foothills of Judea, it says. And they want to know who's done this thing. And they, meaning the men of Judah, answer and say, "It was Samson that did it. We didn't do it. It was Samson." But they don't want to put all the blame on Samson. So they smooth things over. They say, "It was Samson, the son of Lah of that Timnite. And the Philistines came up and they burned her and her father with fire. This was the punishment that she did not, if she did not tell them the riddle. So she was burnt and her father anyway. And Samson said unto them, though ye have done this, yet I will yet be avenged. And after that, I will cease. I'm not done yet. And he smote them hip and thigh with a great slaughter. He went down and dwelt in the top of the rock Edom. And the Philistines went up, and they pitched in Judah and spread themselves in Lehi. Notice how things have grown. When we read the first part, it said that God moved him at times in the camp of Dan. Then he went to Ashkelon. Now we have Timnath. And now the army is out. Things are getting serious. And then we have the men of Judah in verse 11 of chapter 15. They come to the top of the rock of Edom, 3,000 of them, and say to Samson, knowest thou not that the Philistines are rulers over us? What is this that thou hast done to us? Done to us, not for us, to us. This is Judah, whose ensign was the lion, saying, why are you causing trouble? The Philistines are ruling over us, and we're just fine with that. There's not a problem here. Why are you such a troublemaker? But that was the problem. They shouldn't have been fine with that. And Samson's answer was, as they did to me, so have I done to them. There's 3,000 men of Judah. Moses had said years before, if you have faith, one of you will chase 1,000. If they had faith in Yahweh, look what they could have accomplished at that time. But the men of Judah say to Samson in verse 12, we're come down here, we're going to bind you. We're going to tie you up, and then we're going to give you to the Philistines. And that'll make it all better. Not for him, but for them. It was the easy way out. But he talks to them and he says, he didn't want to fight with them. He says, okay, if you won't back me up, then just bind me, but promise me that you're not going to kill me yourselves. He knew what the Philistines were going to do to him, and they did too. How sad. And they bound him. And when he came to Lehi, that's where the Philistines were, the Philistines shouted against him. That's like the shout when the lion roared against him. It's the same word, actually. And the Spirit came mightily upon him again. God was with him once more. And in verse 15 it says, and he found a new jawbone of an ass and put it forth in his hand and took it. Now the Hebrew word here suggests that it was not just a jawbone, and we're going to get a little gross here, but a moist jawbone. Not one that's been baked by the Texas sun for years and years. We're talking fresh, with everything that comes with it. The only time that Hebrew word is found anywhere else is in Isaiah 1, verse 6. It speaks of the putrefying sores of the apostate Israel. And from the crown of their head to the bottom of their feet, Isaiah said, they were full of putrefying sores, moist with corruption. Israel had gone astray. God's guidance was thrown off. That's why their jaw, which is the symbol of their leadership, was putrid. So Samson reaches out and picks up this disgusting thing. And with it, he slew 1,000 men. And it said, they're in heaps upon heaps, he says. With this jawbone, I have slain 1,000 men. We can only picture what it looked like after slaying 1,000 men. And he throws it away. It wasn't pretty to start with. But then we read in the next verse, in the 18th verse, and he was sore athirst, and he called on the Lord and said, thou hast given this great deliverance into the hand of thy servant. And now I die for the thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised. And God clave a hollow spot, a hollow place in that jaw, and there came water thereout. And when he had drunk, his spirit came again, and he revived. Wherefore he called the name of that place En-Hakkori, which is in Lehi unto this day. The jawbone was cast off. But then it says it had to be picked up again, or he would have died. Samson called it En-Hakkori, because he found it, the fountain of him that cries. And the person that cries unto God will be heard. We can see here that despite the cowardliness of Judah, and despite the putrefaction in the nation, God was still working with them. In Judges 16, verse 1, it says, "And then Samson went to Gaza, and once again he saw there an harlot, and he went in to her." Gaza means a fortified place. It was the last of the cities of the Philistines going south before the border of Egypt. Samson was at times being led by the Spirit of God, and at times very much led by his own eyes. And the woman he saw, what a bad use of his eyes, was a harlot, a Philistine harlot. And was told those in Gaza, saying, "Samson has come hither." And they compassed him in and laid wait for him all night in the gate of the city, and were all quiet in the night, saying, "In the morning, when it's daytime, then we'll kill him." And Samson lay till midnight, and arose at midnight, and took the doors and the gates of the city and the two posts, and went away with them, bars and all, upon his shoulders, and carried them up to the top of the hill that was toward Hebron. The promise that we have been discussing all week is the promise that was made to Abraham, that his seed will possess the gates of his enemies. This means that he would have power over his enemies. Samson had just done that. He had just walked away with the military might of the Philistines. They were no longer safe inside of Gaza. But why did he walk to Hebron? We're not told, but we know that Hebron was where the promises were made to Abraham. In verse 4 it says, "And it came to pass afterward that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah." This is the first time in Samson's life that we're told he fell in love. This, we could have a physical attraction, brothers and sisters, that can be strong. But when you're in love, those rose-colored glasses that we hear of, they come on and look out. Love is blind. And although Samson was not literally blind yet, his glasses were really dark. He couldn't see what was going on. His brain had shut down. Delilah, we know, lived in the valley of Sorek. It was just outside Zorah and Eshtaol. It was near the border where Samson lived and where the Philistines were. The word Sorek is only used 3 times in the Bible. In Genesis 49, it's translated choice vine. In Isaiah 5, a noble vine. And the only other place is mentioned in Jeremiah 2, which says, "For of old time I have broken thy yoke and burst thy bands, and thou saidest, I will not transgress, when every high hill and under every green tree thou wanderest, playing the harlot. Yet I have planted thee a noble vine, a holy right seed. How then art thou turned to a degenerate plant and a strange vine to me?" God had planted Israel as a vine in Sorek, and she played the harlot. Think of Samson, brothers and sisters, the Nazarite, the unpruned noble vine, now in love with Delilah the Philistine. The name Delilah, if we go way back in Strong's, means to draw out. And that, brothers and sisters, is what she did to our poor, blind Samson. In Judges 16, we read, "And the lord of the Philistines came up to her and said unto her, Entice him, and see wherein his great strength lieth, and by what means we may prevail against him." These were the lords of the Philistines. There were 5 major cities, 5 lords. They were all here. The army couldn't take care of it. Maybe money can. "Then we may bind him to afflict him, and we'll give every one of us 1,100 pieces of silver." She would have been a millionaire at least, in our terms. She awoke Samson the 3 times and said, "Samson, the Philistines be upon thee." May we wonder, how could Samson be so naive? Didn't it ever occur to him that she was trying to trap him? What was he thinking? Simply, he wasn't thinking. He was enjoying the pleasures of life. He had shut down. his life in service to God. And Delilah said to Samson, "Tell me, I pray thee, wherein thy great strength lieth, and where thou mightest be bound to afflict thee." And Samson said to her, "If they bind me with seven green withs that were never dried, then I shall be weak." But this did not work, as we know, and he broke them. But note, he used the number seven. He had seven locks of hair, so he was weakening and getting closer to tell her the truth. And Delilah said to Samson, "Behold, thou mockest me and told me lies. Now I pray thee, tell me wherewith thou mightest be bound." And he said to her, "If thou bindest me with new ropes that were never occupied, then I shall be weak as another man." Therefore, Delilah did that. And there were liars in wait in her house waiting to bind him. And then she says, and Delilah said to Samson, "Hitherto thou mockest me and told me all these lies. Tell me wherein thou mightest be bound. If thou weave the seven locks of my hair," he's weakening, he's almost given it away, "into the web." And she fastened it with a pin and said to him, "The Philistines be upon thee, Samson." She wakened out of his sleep with the pin of the beam and the web. And she said unto him, doesn't this sound familiar? "And how canst thou say that thou love me when thy heart is not with me? Thou hast mocked me these three times and hast not told me wherein thy great strength lieth." Here we can see when we are carried away by our emotions, we forget the significance of the truth. And the truth is treated very lightly in our lives. She did not know the source of his strength, but she knew the source of his weakness. She knew what buttons to push. So she starts to press on him emotionally because he loved the woman. And she said, "You have mocked me three times." The word "mocked" actually means cheated or to do deceitfully. And it came to pass when she pressed on him daily with her words and urged him, so that his soul was sore vexed unto death. We know what Joseph did when he was in this situation. He fled. And we know what Samson should have done. And we know what we should do if we are in similar situations. Brethren and sisters and young people, so easy to let our eyes and our hearts lead us into tempting places and situations. But we must be strong and choose that right course. It's not the easiest course. It's not the most pleasing course to the flesh. But we know it is the right course. And then he says, "If I be shaven..." He said, there was the truth of the matter. He had told all his heart. And he said, "There is no razor come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb." It really had nothing to do with his hair. The hair was only a symbol of it. He told her, in fact, that he was under a vow to God, and he had just broken that vow. The word Nazarite, according to Strong, means to separate, that is, consecrate, figuratively an unpruned vine, like an unshorn Nazarite. We see in the word in Leviticus 25, starting at the fourth verse, "But in the seventh year shall be a Sabbath of rest unto the land, for a Sabbath to the Lord. Thou shalt neither sow thy field nor prune thy vineyard, that which groweth of its own accord of thy harvest. Thou shalt not reap, neither gather the grapes of the vine undressed." The vine undressed is Nazar. Samson had long hair, so he was trying to keep his vow. He stood out as a man who, despite his weaknesses, and manifesting some fruit before God. When the vow of the Nazarite was fulfilled successively, the hair was cut and it was put under the fire to fuel the sacrifices, showing fellowship with God. But if the vow was broken, it was shaved, and the hair was not put with the sacrifice. It was cast out. Think of Samson's hair. Samson's hair was cut, and it fell into the lap of Delilah. It fell into the lap of a Philistine. We are told in Jeremiah 7, this is what had happened to Israel. All Israel should have been spiritual Nazarites, serving God all the days of their life. But they weren't. Jeremiah 7:28 says, "And this nation that obeyeth not the voice of the Lord, their God, nor receiveth correction, truth is perished and is cut out of their mouth. Cut off thine hair, O Jerusalem, and cast it away." So she made him sleep on her knees, and she called for a man and caused him to shave off the 7 locks of his head. And then she began to poke him, afflict him, and his strength went from him. And she said, "As before, the Philistines are upon thee, Samson." And he awoke out of his sleep, as at other times, and said, "I will shake myself," or shout a battle cry, and go out and fight. For he wist not that the Lord had departed from him. In Judges 16:19-20, it says, "And Yahweh departed from him, so his strength going from him was the same as Yahweh departed from him." He had broken his vow. What about us? We have made a vow at baptism. How are we keeping it? Are we keeping it? When the hair was shaven and he woke up, he wasn't aware that God had departed from him. And that also is exactly like us, isn't it? We have ups and downs in the truth, and sometimes we slide further from the truth, and we make excuses for ourselves. We say, "Oh well, everybody makes mistakes, and God realizes that we're flesh." And we look at others and their weaknesses, which makes our weaknesses look a lot smaller, of course. And sometimes it takes a major issue in our life to get us to refocus. And we suddenly realize the importance of what we're doing, or more importantly, what we're not doing. The problem, I see I'm running long, we're almost done here. The problem with the Laodicean Ecclesia was not that they were poor, as we heard, or naked or blind, but they didn't recognize it. Weaknesses grow and mature, just as spiritual strength does. We must not compare ourselves one with another, for there is only one that we should compare ourselves to. And then we know the Philistines did a very merciful thing to Samson. They gouged out his eyes. That was the problem. That's where his problem was his whole life. He saw a woman. And then they bound him with fetters of brass. Double brass, it says. Brass, a symbol of sin's flesh. Doubled in man's case. It bound him as a slave to his lust. And now they put him grinding in the grinding house instead of an ass. Round and round he goes working for them. He was a slave of sin. Now he's a slave of the Philistines. God had departed from him. When God departs from us, brothers and sisters, is there anything less? But then the Philistines made a grave mistake. The Philistines gathered together for a great sacrifice to their god Dagon. "Our God hath delivered Samson into our enemy into our hand." They praised their God. "Our God hath delivered our enemies, the destroyer of our country, which slew many of us." The Philistines had just gone too far. They had challenged Yahweh. It was one thing to challenge Israel, but do not challenge Yahweh. And while their hearts were merry, they brought Samson to make sport of him. And the house was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there upon the roof. It says 3,000 men and women. Behold, Samson made sport. When it says it was full of men and women, the words actually mean weak and feeble men and women. Also, the lords were there. The weak, the government, the aristocracy, everything was there. And then we picture Samson framed between the two pillars that held up this style of building. The final humiliation, led by a little child. And Samson called upon the Lord and said, "O Lord God, pray, I pray thee, strengthen me, I pray thee, this once. O Lord God, O God, that I may be avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes." If we are estranged from God, we feel lonely. Something is missing in our lives. Samson now sees the seriousness of what he's done. And he addresses Yahweh as Adonai Yahweh, he who will be lords. He knows God will triumph over those false gods. And then he calls unto the Elohim. He calls for God to send his angelic messengers to strengthen him. In verse 30, Samson says, "Let me," or more correctly, "let my soul die with the Philistines." He got it. He finally understood for the first time. He's saying, "I'm just as much a Philistine as they are, and not worthy to be called an Israelite." And he bowed himself. The word bowed in this case means to yield. He had nothing to do, it had nothing to do with his might. His strength was from Yahweh. But then we are told God did not allow him to lie among the uncircumcised. Then his brother and all the house of his father came down. They took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the burying place of Manoah, his father. Remember we said Manoah means a settled spot, a resting place? How appropriate for a man who is listed among the faithful in Hebrews 11. And he will again one day raise and again be made strong. We, brethren and sisters, should be moved at all times, not just at times like Samson. We should be agitated that our ecclesias are not as firm as they should be. We should want to get out there and sting the enemy. We should want to keep the world at bay. In the end, that we, like Samson, might overcome the lust of our eyes and destroy the enemy. May we all receive that inheritance which has been promised to those who remain strong and overcome until the end.